Well,
thank you, Matthew. I guess we are doing 30 minutes instead of 20. So.
No, you're doing 20.
I am. Yeah. So what I'll do is introduce our project funded by USAID on developing heat-tolerant wheat, share a little bit of our data, and then some exciting results that we are trying to use to add more components to that project where we're trying to develop heat-tolerant wheat. We have a pretty large group. The underlying partners are private companies, two from India and one from, well, global, DuPont Pioneer. So the way we are setting this up is the main objective of having private partners is to have alternate avenue of commercialization of the products that we plan to develop from the project. And we believe that just going at the end of that when you have a product and then just going to the partners is not a good time to do that. Rather involve them very early on and then get them involved in the testing and development process and then so that they can guide you and then help you develop the product that they feel is ideal for the market. So that's the role, and then they will be contributing to the project. DuPont Pioneer will be doing a bunch of genotyping and helping us with the biochemical assays, whereas the Indian private companies, MetaHelix and JK Seeds, will be conducting field trials and contributing other know-how for the market. The objectives, the fifth objective is, let's see if it can work, okay, is in addition to the training of scientists, we plan to develop wheat varieties using a combination of approaches including fast breeding, physiology, genetics, QTL mapping, whatever we can lay our hand on. We are going to use that. And then it's just going to go stepwise, do a bunch of QTL analysis. And this, all the approaches we are planning on using are non-GMO because there are other projects, Arcadia, others doing the GM approach. And then we are going through the natural variation route, see what we can exploit there. And just to kind of sort of summarize how we want to incorporate the physiology into the approach, we are targeting these three, which we believe are complementary processes that we plan on improving in wheat, that is photosynthesis under elevated temperature, sugar, conversion of sugar into starch in the developing grain at elevated temperature, and sugar transport. So the plan is that we will study these individually, look for genes that are involved in these processes, look for their thermal tolerance, develop biochemical, genetic DNA markers for these genes, and then use as we develop, we use them in the breeding process is the approach we are planning on taking. In addition to what I just said, that looking for thermal stability, Dr. Vara Prasad, who is a partner on the project, is doing a lot of work on ROs and lipids and linking that with the heat tolerance. So he will be doing that part. And then the enzymes and the genes part, other partners will be doing that. And then it will all this information will be funneled through the fast breeding approach to develop wheat varieties in 5 years. So it's a bit ambitious in that regard, but we are pretty confident that we will be able to do that. Okay, I'm still struggling with the... Okay, just to give you a little idea that where all we are going with this, we went all over the world, Summit, other places, looking for germplasm, available germplasm, ancient germplasm, that has the potential to be heat tolerant. and then we have a collection of about 1,000 lines, very carefully selected, of which we believe that at least 300 of those have been cataloged as having some sort of heat tolerance. So those 300 are the first tier, and then the remaining, we will go through the entire germplasm, and then the plan is to look for what 10 best lines having complementary mechanism of heat tolerance and use those for introgression and variety development process. And this is data Dr. Vara Prasad from K-State generated on root characteristics of a part of the germplasm. I was just amazed with the type of variation exists in this. I have never seen anything like this, and this is all cultivated wheat. No alien line there. You can just see the range, kind of range we are seeing in the root length and the root biomass and then all that. So tremendous amount of variation already available. So now we are just using the same setup to see how the root characteristics respond under heat stress, and then so make that link at some point. So first, it was obvious that we had to develop a controlled condition screening test. So we have developed a variety of those, targeting specific one of those three processes I just mentioned, the photosynthesis and then the grain filling and then the flowering. So each of the controlled condition tests that we have developed target each of these processes I just mentioned. And then all these germplasm will be tested in the field with our partner institutes to find the relationship that how does the controlled condition testing compare with that of the field, and then whatever matches field and controlled condition, then that data will be used to pick the best donors for our introgression process. And this is just an example I'm showing here. These lines that we tested, these are what 70 lines that were well known worldwide to have some sort of heat tolerance in them. And then the test we developed, you can just see that part of these lines, there was just no seed set, so our method is pretty harsh. And then we managed to find some lines, like shown here with the green, which were very clearly tolerant. For example, this one particular line showed essentially no effect on this brutal heat treatment that we gave to these plants, when about half of the lines that were known to be heat tolerant didn't even set any seed. So we have repeated these tests, and they're just pretty repeatable, so we're pretty excited about it. And then we conducted the field trials, on like multi-location field trial on the same lines in India. We're just in the process of analyzing the data and comparing with how does it they compare with what we have seen here. And one visiting scientist wanted to look at the heat stress during early stages of plant growth, including germination. We debated that is it really an issue, but when we start looking at it, then turned out to be that it in some parts of the world, including India, can be a huge issue, because sometimes farmers plant early and then they end up losing yield, and no one knew why. And we think that, I mean, this is just an effect on germination, and this is from exact same seed packet, just grown at a different temperature. And again, the range from essentially no germination, both at a low temperature and high temperature, and then a tremendous amount of variation. Some lines preferred 15 degrees, some preferred 20, 25. So a tremendous amount of variation. Picking a line that would be ideal for a specific temperature, that just gave us some idea that it's probably will be possible that depending upon the soil temperature, ideal line can be selected just from going through natural variation. Similarly for coleoptile, this coleoptile, we are very interested in this from the emergence point of view, both from Washington, Australia, and even worldwide. We believe that if the seed can be planted a little bit deeper and there's without any effect on emergence, the temperature, outside temperature, will not be as much of a factor, then the roots will have to grow a little bit less to access the same amount of water. And coleoptile was implicated in the literature to be affected, that affecting the emergence trait. But then we just studied the temperature had a tremendous influence on coleoptile length as well as emergence. And then again, a lot of variation. That's kind of a common theme for whatever we studied. We found tremendous amount of variation for each of the traits we studied for among just among the collection we have. So this is a detailed study of about 700 of those donor lines. So if you look at this is a emergence, coleoptile length, and if you look on this side of the graph, you will say, well, as the coleoptile length increases, emergence improves. But then we did analysis a little bit differently, that each of these dots, black dots on the right, are individual lines plotted against the coleoptile and emergence. And when we look at that, coleoptile doesn't really seem to have as much of an effect, because in each of the coleoptile class, you get the full range. And now we are looking at mesocotyl and first leaf length, and then the cell density and cell size, looking into the anatomy of germinating seedling to see what really affects seedling emergence, the growth, and then response to temperature. Because early growth, in addition to having a good stand and avoiding crust and all, competition with weeds is a huge issue. So the plant that can establish good stand early on will have an advantage. So we are spending quite a bit of time looking at this. But amazingly enough, seeds that were germinated at different temperatures for 10 days, then returned to normal temperatures, plant never forgot that. So this data, what I'm showing here, is only 7 lines germinated at different temperatures, but then after 10 days, plants return to normal conditions. Some lines didn't care, but others, they suffered up to 20% yield loss. So now, I think we are set for next 10 years understanding the plant memory, that how does plant remember that it was exposed or it was germinated at 10 degrees Celsius or 15 degrees Celsius for 10 days. The epigenetics is probably involved, so we're looking into that. But this is kind of something new that got started. But I was just amazed that plant, and we repeated this experiment 3 times already, and very consistent results, as you can see from the error bars. So all this information that will be coming into, then this is sort of the strategy we are using, that we are going through the entire collection. We will select 10 donor lines, and then we picked one mega variety from the endogigantic plane that we will use to introgress these value-added traits like heat and then emergence and others. By using our fast breeding method we call marker-assisted background selection, where we will identify QTLs and simultaneously use those into the breeding approach, and then in a good year we can finish this process in about 2 years or less. With our new data on the pH gene, so originally we weren't thinking about using wild relatives. I mean, wild relatives, I'm sure you all have seen some of the wild relatives doing, looking very, very happy even at 40 degrees Celsius. So we just recently cloned pH gene. The paper just came out in PNAS last maybe 3 weeks ago. So now it opened up a newer opportunity for us to use alien species to target a transfer of some of the heat tolerance or other value-added traits into cultivated wheat. For those of you who are not familiar with the PH gene, so it doesn't allow the pairing between wheat and the alien species chromosomes when it is present, and when the gene is knocked out, then that pairing can occur. So now that we have the gene, we can manipulate that to induce pairing in a targeted manner. So this is kind of the structure of the gene, very interesting gene. I won't spend a lot of time talking about it, but maybe I'll learn by the time I'm done. So the 5B copy, so PH gene was known to be present on 5B chromosome of wheat, not on 5A or 5D. So it goes through alternate splicing, very different protein of 5B, and then 5A is a truncated version. So it matches really well with all the data available, that what 5A copy does, what 5D copy does. So this agrees fairly well with that. And then with the RNAi, when we did that for the gene, the phenotype we got was very similar to the mutant for the gene. We did it both with WIGS as well as stable RNAi, and we could induce homologous pairing just fine. I'm afraid to use pointer. Okay. Okay, here is, I think this is better, maybe. So the aberrant, when we did RNAi, very high level of aberrant chromosome pairing. But one thing we also noticed, which was not seen in the original mutant, was that the alignment on the metaphase plate was disrupted severely, implicating centromere in the function of the gene. And then that is, we are just following that lead further. These are just some of the RNAi plants showing the aberrant chromosome pairing as the expression of the gene. So this is 100% of the expression, down to 49% or even 17% in one. The aberrant parent pairing of the chromosomes proportionately increase. So in the it increases to say up to even 90% of the cells showing aberrant chromosome pairing when the gene is silenced, up to only showing 17% of the original expression. And then the same way the multivalent proportion increased to about 0.74, 0 to 2 per cell, a pretty high number of multivalents. But that doesn't really mean that the recombination is occurring. So that's the next step. We need to see that if we can induce recombination using this gene. But we have indirect evidence that it happens. Amazingly enough, this gene is functional in Arabidopsis. So by silencing the ortholog of the gene in Arabidopsis, we managed to induce multivalents in Arabidopsis, shown in the middle of the slide. And the ortholog of the gene is present in rice, it's present in barley, it's present in maize. So we're just in the process of studying that what is this gene doing in those diploid species or ancient polyploids. And more excitingly, the 5B copy of the gene is metaphase 1 specific. The expression of the gene, I mean, how many genes do we really know that expresses so specifically at metaphase 1? And so it agrees with the function of the gene as known in the literature, that the chromosome pairing happens during prophase and gets resolved as we get into metaphase, and then the gene expression, especially of the 5B copy, matches with that, not of the 5A or the 5D copy. So based on that, the 5B copy evolved this novel function of pairing, either by different structure, which we know that is quite different from 5A and 5D, or due to this unique expression pattern that we see, which is metaphase 1 specific. This is that indirect evidence I was talking about. So based on all of our data, it became pretty clear that this gene functions by affecting centromere function. But while we do those experiments and then show that it actually is the case, we start looking at some indirect evidence. And what I'm showing you here is, let's see if I can get the arrow working. So each of this line is a different recombinant line between wheat and rye. So when on this particular slide, I say wheat-rye translocation lines with wheat centromere. So that this is 1B chromosome here. And what we are looking at is a very small segment of 1B, the tip of it. And all these lines there, the map is different markers mapping in this small region. And wherever there is a blue box here, it is wheat, and the other lighter color is rye. So you can just up to 13 switches within this very small segment. And this recombination was induced by silencing PH1 gene. Okay, but it is centromere specific. It is the lines produced by exact same method. Rye centromere, the switches are a lot more normal than what we expect, one or two switches. So centromere is clearly playing a role there, and then since this recombination happened via PH1 gene, then we think that this is at least indirect evidence that it supports that what we think, that PH gene functions via modulating centromere function. So now the next step that we are using our gene to induce homologous recombination between wild relatives and wheat, and see if we can actually do it by using virus-induced gene silencing transiently or using our RNAi construct. So that's what we are doing next. And then in the meantime, we are screening the suspected wild species that are known to be or that are expected to be heat tolerant, and then have those lined up. And by the time we optimize this method, we will be ready for to try some of that alien introgression. So with that, I will stop here. And then if I'm allowed, maybe I'll be able to answer one question or two.
Yeah, one or two quick questions.
Yes, sure, Beth.
Taken 26 genes out of the 91 gene locus and done the silencing, right?
Right.
But you did not go back to the CDC kinases that the Jardinus group did.
Right.
You only did the CDC24.
Right.
So would the CDC kinases have any role in this? Because you focused on the 26 rather than the entire 91.
Right. So CDC2-4 and the entire complex is actually present proximal to where we map PH1 gene. So that is in the paper. I only had 20 minutes, but I can show you the data later. So we mapped 2-4 and others, and they all map proximal to where we map PH1 gene.
PH1. But you didn't do CD kinases that came out of the cluster that came out of the Jardinus lab. You didn't do silencing on those.
We did.
You did?
Yes, it is in the paper.
Good.
Yeah. We did one. Right, but
we did one, yeah.
But then we mapped about 6 genes present in the entire region, mapped physically and showed that none of those map in the region where we map the PIGN. Yeah.
Anything
yes.
else? Otherwise, thanks very much.
Thank you.